Have you ever come across a strange story, weird history, odd tale that made you scratch your head and say, hey, I'd like to know a little bit more about that? Well, you're in luck, and you're in the right place listening to the right podcast, because this is the story of... And welcome back to the next episode of the Story of Podcast, where each week we choose a topic, we research it independently, we share nothing with each other, we meet back up to discuss what we have found, and that, folks, is the episode that you are listening to right now. I'm Smith.
I'm Joe.
I'm Jay.
And we have an incredible guest with us this week. We're so super psyched and so super thankful. If you listened to last week's episode about the mole people, we are doing Mole People Part 2, and if you haven't listened to the episode from last week, we'll pause for a second, go back and listen to it. Great, I'm glad that you listened to it. Awesome. And then you no doubtly heard us refer to this man multiple times and his work regarding this topic, Eric K. Swanson, and we were really fortunate enough to reach out, and Eric got back to us, and he is on the show with us on this episode. So, Eric, welcome aboard. Thank you so much for being here, and we appreciate it, man. Welcome. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to reach out and to have a conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for coming.
We're psyched about this. Quick, before we start, Eric, if you just want to introduce yourself and let our listeners know kind of who you are, what you do, and where they can find your content and all of your information.
Sure. Yeah. Like Smith said, my name is Eric K. Swanson. That's also Eric with a K. You can check out my YouTube channel, which is Eric K. Swanson, or my website, EKS.TV. I make documentaries, essentially, varying lengths. I've got some that are as short as 3 minutes and some that are as long as an hour and 10 minutes. Just kind of whatever length the story requires. And on a variety of topics, I made three or four actually videos about mole people, and I've covered history, I've covered kind of paranormal things, Bigfoot sightings, stuff like that, just kind of whatever floats my boat and seems like it'd be fun to make and interesting to learn about and explore.
You're like literally the perfect guest.
You fit right in. I was just going to say that.
We actually just released a big Bigfoot episode on Tuesday this week, and quite a bit of history. Yeah, I'm a history teacher, so it kind of works all well. Joe is also a teacher. He's a science teacher, so he does all mumbo jumbo and magic.
I'm the rational one. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. That's witchcraft.
I saw Eric actually had a video on the Montauk Project as well.
Did you really?
A buddy of mine, Chris Garitano, I'll give him a shout out. He made a documentary called Montauk Chronicles, which is that's also on YouTube, I think Tubi, Amazon, all over the place. It's a fantastic doc. And then when he released it on DVD and Blu-ray, I had gone with him for some of the interviews and kind of shot second camera. And so I put together a little behind the scenes making a featurette, of him, his thoughts on his kind of, I think it was like a 10-year exploration into this subject of all the crazy conspiracy theories surrounding that.
Yeah, we did an episode on that. I think season one, I think it was like episode 3 or 4. That was such an insane topic. That is just, it's so crazy. All of the theories that have to do with it. Stranger Things, like all of it, man. Everything all bundled into one is super interesting. And you're the perfect guest for our show. So, we were talking about mole people in the last episode. And if you've listened to our show before, you know that we usually kind of take a comedic twist or a comedic tinge on things. But for this particular topic, we took more of a respectful approach and just had a straightforward discussion about it. As we were saying to Eric before we began recording, it's not funny, because these are human beings, right? These are individuals and just telling their story. And so I guess I'll start us off first. Eric, where did you come up with the idea? How did you get into this particular topic with these gentlemen?
I'm going to say maybe like 2007 or maybe early 2008. I was working late one night at a news station in Manhattan, and I was on the subway going home, probably like 11:30 at night or somewhere in that vicinity. And I saw a guy just jump down off the subway platform onto the tracks and start walking. And he had a bag slung over his shoulder. I was just blown away. I had heard of mole people, and I always thought it was an urban legend, kind of like I mentioned earlier, like the alligators in the sewers, and just fun, you know, kind of like Bigfoot, I guess, you know, for lack of a better analogy. But I happened to see a dude just it just sat with me and kind of stuck in my head. And I, over the next several weeks and months, just tried learning everything I could about it. And I had kind of been, you know, out interviewing some other homeless folks on the street and just really, you know, just had to know more until I found out about the Freedom Tunnel on the Upper West Side and
Yeah.
then went down there.
Joe, you want to step in, Joe?
The three of us just like flipped out. Nobody saw that. Eric, I had the same exact experience and I put it on the show last week. The
Oh, wow.
same exact story. It was probably 2011 or 12, but I was in a subway station after a show and by myself, and I saw a guy walk by me with a bag, jump down the tracks, and just disappear into the tunnel. And I was like, there was nobody else in the station. I was like, did that really just happen? That's
You waited till the
hysterical.
end to tell us about that.
Yes, I did. I did.
We're like, why didn't
The
you open
story at
with
the end of
that?
the episode, we're like, bro, what? What do you mean? Like, you're telling us this now at 8:57? Like, what? So when you just mentioned that, I was like, no.
That's so funny. Okay.
That's crazy. If you haven't checked out Eric's videos, you know, particularly pertaining to Walter and Carlos, I mean, really, please do. They're phenomenal, and they're heart-wrenching. And so going through the research for this was such an emotional roller coaster for me. And I didn't know how to react, you know. We spoke about this on the last episode, and I wanted to get your take on it. I mean, what are your thoughts? So I felt there's that part that you feel bad, and you're like, all right, this individual's living, you know, Carlos is living under a manhole cover. And Walter is living in like a little cubby, right, 20 feet above the ground. And there's this kind of part that's like, well, I really feel bad for these guys. But I noticed in their interviews, they seemed genuinely happy. You know, like Walter seemed like he was cool, like he was good. And then so now I'm struggling with like, where, who am I to feel bad for someone when this guy looks like he's happy? Like, did you experience that at all? Like kind of not really necessarily knowing how to feel?
Yeah, it's tough because it's like you don't want to, you know, I didn't want to judge them, you know, and since then, much more recently, I've interviewed other homeless folks, and some people genuinely just don't want to participate in society, whatever, for whatever reason, you know. And I mean, let's be honest, a lot of society sucks, you know. So it's like if folks can get by, like it's certainly not easy, you know, try living on the street. Even having a place that they can call their own in the tunnel, you know, like Walter would go out canning, and I mean he was a hustler, and by that I mean he would hustle, not you know, not like he was trying to scam people at pool or something. He would, you know, go out canning. He would find old books that he would sell to bookshops. He would fix computers when he could find the parts and sell old computers that he fixed up. Carlos did some of the same. But it's like, you know, these gentlemen work and worked very hard to maintain at least some sort of living. But primarily, my impression is that they got most of what they needed from what new people on the surface of New York City were throwing out. And, you know, that kind of says a lot too, that these guys can eat well enough. I mean, Carlos is, I think he was 48 when I first met him, 47, 48, and I think he's about 64 now, you know. So, and he looks fit as well. He's in better shape than I am, you know. He's in phenomenal condition for a 64-year-old man, and he just, you know, is able to find everything he needs just on the street, you know. That so for him to be content living in that way, who am I to judge and who am I to try to tell him he's wrong? You know, that seems silly to me to try to convince someone that they're not really happy.
And that's kind of like what I struggled with was like, you know, like I feel bad for this guy, but then it's like you had said, like, does that come from a societal judgment? You know, like feel bad for him because what he's not necessarily living on what, you know, like society deems, right, to be the correct way to do something. Because, you know, and we mentioned in the episode last week, these guys were free, essentially, right? I mean, they just seemed like, you know, and Walter had said it too, he's free. And yeah, in order to survive like that, these guys had to work their asses off, for sure. You know, you had to get up, I would imagine, you had to get up and get everything you need on a daily basis because, you know, you're not necessarily going shopping for 2 weeks ahead of time with food. You've got to make sure that
it's a day-to-day thing.
Yeah, you know, it was funny. I was, and it was kind of funny because we all watched your videos, but we didn't coordinate that. Like, we got on the show and we just were like, oh, yeah, I saw this guy, Carlos, or like, you know what I mean?
Oh, the Carlos video.
The Carlos one, yeah. So I'm talking to my wife about that, and it's kind of like to Danny's point, it's like, man, there's some days I might want to just walk out of my house and not deal with this. And, you know, in some way, it was like, I get it. Like, I'd rather not be, sometimes there's some days you don't want to be a part of society. I felt really bad for him though when they evicted him from his little place. Yep. in the suit. I was like, who was he hurting? You know, he wasn't hurting anybody. So
yeah, that I saw an article within the past 3 or 4 years, but it was written in maybe somewhere between 2013 and 2015, where someone had speculated that, or they had heard second or third hand or whatever, that an Amtrak bigwig was on the commuter train, looked out the window, saw all the old graffiti all over the walls, and then ordered the tunnel cleaned up because they did a terrible job, but they tried painting over all the graffiti. And obviously, there's new graffiti there now. I mean, the other thing is, like, when I was first there, there was, like, you were literally just walking. I think there was old basketball courts, and you could just walk behind the fence of the basketball court, walk through a construction site, and you were in the tunnel. Whereas now you're walking past, you know, a nice outdoor fitness area. You're 100 yards behind a cafe full of tourists. There's bucket trucks, and the parks department has a, you know, shipping containers that they keep their lawnmowers and whatnot in. Like, the area sees way more traffic in general than it did 16 years ago when I was first there.
Yeah, so it's harder to hide in plain sight right now, especially the gentrification of a lot of different areas. So I wanted to ask you, and maybe you had mentioned it in your video, how did you come across Walter and Carlos? Like, where did you meet them first? Like, how did that go?
Well, what I did was, once I had learned about, you know, folks living in that tunnel and just about the tunnel in general, what I had found on the internet, I think, was like that old New York Times article. And I had no idea where they were going to be. So I actually went all the way up Riverside Park into Harlem and had to climb a fence out of the park there to get down onto the train tracks. I just went into the north end of the tunnel with a flashlight and my camera and walked the entire length of the tunnel. And it's scary as hell, I'll tell you that, man.
That's what I was going to ask.
Every little sound, you're like, oh my God, like what was that? You know, because you hear horror stories of, you know,
of course,
everywhere, where, you know, you're going to get jumped, this going to happen, that's going to happen. And, you know, there is all this beautiful graffiti everywhere. So obviously, at some point, people spent a lot of time down there. I'm not the only guy that was there. And basically, I think it was the very first time when I got to the south end. And then, you know, I got a little, by that point, I had been in the tunnel for a couple hours. And so I was feeling a little more comfortable. I could finally see daylight again. And I, you know, just started filming a little bit of the tracks and the graffiti and getting my bearings. And then I, you know, for lack of a better description, I saw this squirrely looking dude, and, you know, I was nervous, but I was like, you know what, I'm going to go up and talk to him. You know, like, the way that I film, I use a monopod, and I've always looked at it as, if I need to, this thing becomes an aluminum baseball bat real quick, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
Was there ever a situation, though, that you felt like there might be danger?
Honestly, not back then. I've been back in the tunnel several times over the past couple of years. And one of those times, I was down there and saw they were off quite a ways, 100 yards away or so. They were probably like, you know, teenagers, early 20s. And me being foolish, I like waved at them, you know, just like, oh, whatever, I'll just be friendly. And then they turned around and started walking towards me. And all of a sudden, like, I just got a sense of panic of like, there's four dudes here. Like, are they going to jump me and take my camera gear? And, you know, they're probably just urban explorers or going to do some graffiti, or maybe they even saw one of my videos and wanted to go see where Walter's house was or something. But yeah, that's the only time. And I was probably just being paranoid and they were probably fine, you know?
So obviously they didn't jump you. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, I scooted out the rabbit hole real quick, actually.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think I would have done the same thing. Yeah.
I was a lot braver and more adventurous when I was, you know, in my 30s.
I have a question about Walter. I just watched the Walter video again, and it's kind of weird. Like, Danny just asked, like, how you met these guys, because Walter has been in other documentaries. He was in like Time magazine. Like, he was kind of a celebrity of the mole people. So were you led to him? Did people say like, oh, you got to talk to this guy, Walter, like, you got to go find him? Or did you just happen upon him?
I just happened upon him. The first time I met him is actually at the beginning of that video. I just hit the record button as I was walking up to talk to him to see if it would be okay to interview him.
He was pretty popular. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, he was. And like, I know they did the French documentary, you said, right around the same time that they were there. Did you bump into them at all?
No, I didn't. Walter obviously mentioned it. I included it in the video. I think Carlos might have mentioned it to me as well. That I don't, I could be imagining that, you know, or misremembering. I had never run into them. And another guy there, Bert, who didn't want me to film him, he had mentioned them. It was funny. They were all talking to me like, you know, oh, this has already been done. Why even bother? You know, like, no one's going to find this interesting more than once. But yeah, I didn't run into them. But the funny thing is, the guy, I think his first name is Steve, I don't recall his last name, the guy who led them through the Freedom Tunnel there, he's been in other stuff. He's like kind of I don't know if he still is, 10 or 12 years ago, he was really big in urban exploring and things like that. And so he's led folks around. I saw a thing where he led some guy up onto the top of the Williamsburg Bridge. They scaled to the top, which is nuts in my opinion. But
yeah, that's crazy. No, thanks. I'm good.
But yeah, I think it's just a coincidence that, you know, Walter had just been there for so long that enough people had been down there. I mean, there's been, you know, a gentleman, I believe he was Dutch from the Netherlands. He made two photojournalist books, one I think in the mid 90s and then another one in the early 2000s, right around, I think it might have been right after I was down there, he kind of did a follow-up. And the other big name was a man named I believe it was Bernard. He lived at the north end of the tunnel. I never met him, but he was there in like up until probably 95 when Amtrak first cleared people out. He was in Jerry Springer. He was in, you know, a couple of like AP news stories. He was in that book by Jennifer Toth, The Mole People. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he was like he was actually the real big kind of spokesperson celebrity.
He was the godfather.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask this. Did you see, what really intrigued me was this idea, and some of that was from the Jennifer Toth book, I think, and that there was this shared community and almost like these roles in it. Did you happen to see a lot of that? Like, did you see a lot of, you know, community roles or the protection and safety type of atmosphere that they talk about? But they like almost a hierarchy, even.
Honestly, I personally didn't see anything like that. When I went down there in like 2008, 2009, whenever it was, that I knew of, there was like, I would say less than 10 people in that stretch of tunnel.
Okay.
So there wasn't even enough people for Walter. And then that guy, Bert, I was mentioning, Carlos, the guy who lived next to Carlos, Brian, who I actually never met him. And then there was another woman living further up in the north half of the tunnel. I never met her. And then I'm just accounting, maybe there was a handful of other folks. And then there was other people living, I think, further south. But it was more just, you know, the people, Walter and Carlos and Brian and Bert, all knew each other. And, you know, Walter would help folks out to, you know, fix a computer or, you know, here, borrow my Mac OS disk or whatever. Other than that, I don't think they were really kind of, you know, it wasn't like they were, like she wrote in her book. I don't think, I kind of have a suspicion that might have been fantasy.
There's a lot of people, there's some people who came out, I know, and have accused her of, you know, being a little exaggerating with some of it. Because I know somebody who was like an expert in the subway said that a lot of the areas didn't line up to like what would be there and stuff. But I mean, she swears by it. Just interested in that because I think the last estimate was like 2,000 plus people they think live underneath, and they really don't know. They could be way more than that or whatever. But
well, I met another gentleman. I only chatted with him briefly, but in 2022, and he said he was just passing through. He lived in a different part of the tunnel. I have a rough idea where it is, but you know, I'm not going to share that info. Sure. I never went there, but there was an article, I want to say in like October, November of 2022, I think, where a fire broke out underneath Hell's Kitchen somewhere, and there was a community of homeless people living under there.
Wow, that's crazy.
Wild. It's wild to think under your feet.
Yeah,
like there's life going on.
There's a potential, you know, whole other city. Now, you'd mentioned a few times that Walter had fixed computers. Did he have a background in that? I'm curious. Like, did he just like kind of learn how to do that, or is that something that he had done, I guess, prior in his earlier years? Did he go into that at all?
I think he pretty much just picked it up.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I've been in touch with his daughter a few times, and I'm hoping to be able to interview her and get, you know, more info about her father and, you know, what that experience must have been like for her. But I think, you know, she said he was a veteran, so he was in the military in some capacity. And then, I think he just kind of worked, you know, odd jobs in kind of the bar scene and restaurants and whatnot downtown. And then once that all kind of dried up for him, he just, you know, was canning and selling books and figuring out how to use computers and whatnot.
That's impressive. That's
very resourceful. His setup. Yeah.
Yeah, his setup was incredibly impressive. Yeah, you know, like the bathroom is over here. There's the dining room and the kitchen. Here's my living room. And I mean, he had everything he needed. He had, he had the toaster, right? He had the toaster in there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he had a microwave.
Well, was it Carlos that had the microwave and the fridge, right?
Carlos, yes.
Yeah.
Two fridges.
Yeah, I mean, it's so impressive to see, you know, they were able to get electricity and you know, from wherever, right? Wherever he got it from. But, you know, the ability to adapt to those situations, and not only just adapt, but they seemed as if they were, like, thriving. They were just living their lives and just doing well. And that was, like, again, that emotional roller coaster that I referenced earlier was, like, I went from, like, feeling like, oh, my God, I feel so bad for these guys, to being impressed. And being like, oh my God, look at these guys. You know, like there's no, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I'd be able to survive like that. I don't, you know, I'd be way out of my element, you know, and they were able to do that. And it's just like, should people have to live like that? But at the same time, if it's their choice, then who are we to say anything? And who am I to judge them? Because if these kids are happy, they're just genuinely happy. Like when you had the video where you met back up with Carlos later on, and he had his bike and everything was, you know, he's incredibly happy. Like, look, it just seemed.
He had a great disposition, that guy.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
his disposition was.
Yeah, it's almost like a superpower.
I felt bad for when I get upset about stuff. You know what I mean? I was like, God, this guy just knows what life's about.
Well, considering Carlos's backstory, like he came from Cuba, correct?
Right.
And so that's like, you know, I mean, he was escaping something. He was escaping something that was obviously, like, that's insane too, to think about, to be living essentially on the streets of New York City and just be so happy. And I mean, just to imagine how miserable it must have been right back in Cuba, right? Where, I mean, that's just like, that's, you know, like to have the, you know, the wherewithal to have that understanding there too. is something that's, you know, we can't be lost on us either, right? I mean, to experience probably what he experienced and to see this, and where us as normal Americans are like, oh my God, but he may have had more in this part of his life than he ever had in Cuba. And that's pure speculation.
He was happier living in a manhole in America than living in Cuba, you know, not to make a joke of it, but like, just think about that. That's crazy. He was so happy just doing what he was doing and not being in Cuba, like whatever he was experiencing there. And even when he lost his manhole, he was on the street with his bike and he was still happy. You know, he's still cheerful about it.
What do you, as far as like Carlos goes and Walter, do you think that there's a certain type of personality for somebody to be able to kind of step away from society and do what they did?
I think you need to be resourceful to some degree. You know, like I met a man in northern New York 2 years ago who was living in a rusty box truck. And I mean, he had it from the facade of it. He built this little facade. It looked like a, you know, he had a picket fence out front. Like you never would have thought that this was an old beat up box truck, you know. And he's another guy where he's out eating these cannon every day and picking up odd jobs in the town he lives in. People, you know, hire him to rake leaves or, you know, help carry shingles onto a roof or whatever to do a roofing job. I mean, I think it's like you just need to be resourceful. But I feel like in Carlos and Walter's instances, they did have the advantage of being in New York City. Like an interesting thing, if you look at the French documentary, when they went into Carlos's home, he had one fridge. And they supposedly filmed within 2 months before or after when I filmed. I think it was before. Carlos tells me he thinks I was there first. Regardless, it doesn't matter. The one fridge he had is not either of the two fridges that he had when I filmed. So this man got three refrigerators in a span of 2 months.
Down a manhole. Like
better than
down a manhole.
I have enough trouble getting the fridge through my front door. You know, like I had to take the doors off, and this guy's got three fridges going down into a manhole. Like that's incredibly impressive.
You know? I'm even worse. I pay the guys.
To show the, if you keep your eyes open, the amount of resources that are available in a big city like New York, you know?
That's true. If this was another city, you know, in the middle.
Sure, or living upstate, right? If you're living upstate, that's a hell of a lot harder, right, to come across all
the resources. God forbid, like you lived in North Carolina or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Right? Especially where I am. Middle of nowhere.
Or even like L.A. or Jacksonville, where those are large cities, obviously. Like L.A., I think, is the second biggest in the country. They're huge cities still, but they're geographically huge.
Yes. Mm.
You know, whereas Walter and Carlos, they could walk, you know, 20 minutes and they're in the Upper West Side where there's three restaurants on every block that they could go and get food from the street, you know?
Yeah.
It's a really good point.
Did you, all right, so I came across information from somebody who called himself JC, who said he had lived, you know, under the streets, and he had claimed that there were six levels of tunnels that went under the streets. And he had mentioned things like there were children and families and people that hadn't seen, you know, the light of day in years. Have you come across that? Did Walter or Carlos ever mention anything that like tunnels that went down that deep? Like, is that, do you believe that exists?
I've never heard anything about that. I mean, I think just the infrastructure in New York City, I think probably does go six levels down below the ground. And, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff under there. So like has nothing to do with homeless people or anything. But years ago, I worked at a building on, I think it was 57th and 11th. And they had these old catacombs that were for cattle when they used to bring cattle in to New York City and take it down to the meatpacking district in tunnels under the city. So it's like there are all these old weird remnants that most people have no idea about.
I mean, theoretically, there, if you know about them, and you know, like, why not? You know, that doesn't.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I know there's old like subway stops and old subway tunnels that are no longer used. And, you know, I was reading somewhere that there was this like beautiful subway stop with stained glass windows and beautiful mosaics and completely lost to time underground that nobody realizes about. And so who's to say that nobody is necessarily living there? It's interesting. You know, it certainly is. I wanted to ask you, there is the part, it broke my heart, that towards at the end of that, the last video with Walter, he had passed. How did you find out? Like, I mean, that broke my heart. That really did. I got really sad knowing that he had passed away.
Yeah. So I originally found that out probably, like, I want to say maybe 2015 or 16. And I actually saw it from a video online. Someone made a short film. I think it was like a Columbia School of Journalism student or something like that, who went and interviewed that gentleman I was mentioning earlier, Bernard Isaac. And they actually knocked on the entrance to Carlos's spot. This film came out, I think, in like 2012 or whatever. I didn't see it till a couple years later. And when they knocked, Carlos wouldn't talk to them, but you could hear him. And you know, Bernard was asking, like, hey, is Walter here? And Carlos said that he died. And I was like, oh, you know, I was just as shocked as Bernard in the video. So, oh my God, he's dead. And then I went back down there at one point, like 2016 or 17, and I couldn't find anybody. So, you know, I just assumed, well, you know, why would someone, when they're refusing to do an interview on camera, why would they just in passing make up a lie about someone passing away, you know?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, once I reconnected with Carlos, you know, a few years ago, I was able to confirm and ask him more, you know?
Yeah. Do you still meet up with Carlos? Do you still talk with him?
Yeah, I haven't talked to him in about a month, but I'm planning on hopefully, you know, seeing him probably in the next couple of weeks when I can get down that way. I tried to go meet up with him, I want to say like a month and a half ago, and when I gave him a call, he didn't answer for whatever reason. But yeah, we, you know, usually I try to talk to him like once a month, just make sure everything is okay and make sure he's doing all right. Fortunately, he's got another good friend, gentleman Jose. He's a real nice kid. He's young, I don't know, somewhere in his 20s. He's a real nice dude who's, he works right, you know, on the same block or within a block or two of where Carlos currently spends his nights. So he's, you know, helps him out when he can, and just so he has a small community of folks to talk to also, you know?
Somebody looking out for him, you know, watching his back. And it was amazing to see that in the video for Carlos, somebody set up a GoFundMe for him. That was awesome.
Yeah.
That was incredible to see, you know, people step up and say, hey, let's, you know, we've all got something, you know, a little something to give. Let's hook him up. Let's help him out. That's cool. And that's one of the beautiful things about your videos too, was that, again, there is this stereotype about people who are experiencing, you know, homelessness or experiencing houselessness. And I loved the fact that your video, again, was able to humanize these folks and to give them a face and to give them a name. It's just such an important thing, especially nowadays. In the last couple of years, the vitriol that seems to be everywhere you look, you know, in the United States, whether it be online or just, you know, social media or just in general with human beings, to show a more human side to a group that just is such an afterthought to so many Americans. I think it's just incredibly important for you to have done that. That's awesome.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. I mean, I agree. It's like, I feel, to me, a big thing of what a lot of my videos, you know, those, the Carlos and Walter videos and some of the others that I've done is that, like you said, is to try to humanize and show, like, not every homeless person is a fentanyl or meth addict, you know, like a lot of these folks, we have no idea, even what they're willing to share on camera, which some folks have been very open, they're still holding back something. You know, we really don't know every detail of their situation. And, you know, unfortunately, it could happen to anybody. If you get nailed with a medical bill or, you know, some company buys out your company and you get laid off and, you know, you're in the middle of a recession with record high inflation, you know, there's only so long your savings is going to last.
Yeah.
So it's like, I kind of feel like if you turn on the news, every homeless person is dangerous.
Yeah.
So I wanted to try to combat that, where it's like, I don't know, knock on wood, I've been fortunate that I haven't met too many dangerous homeless folks. You know, they're, most of them, it's like, just take the time to talk to them and treat them like another human being, and they're appreciative.
Sure.
And just interesting folks.
Yeah. Who's got, yeah. I'm sure they've had some stories too.
Yeah.
I wanted to just add on, like, the Walter video, especially again. He was so resourceful. He was so content. At least he portrayed himself that way. I almost felt like good for him when he was saying, like, you know, everyone got cleared out, but they missed him and they didn't clear him out. So he had the whole tunnel to himself. And the police would come by and just, you know, go past him and they didn't even know he was there and stuff. It was like I was rooting for him. It was just, and he even described it. He's like, this is my castle. And I was like, that's so cool. You know what I mean? Now, maybe it was all a show. Maybe he was just doing it for the camera or something. But I felt the same way. Like, oh, my God, I feel so bad for this guy. But then afterwards, I'm like, no, he's good. Like he's, or at the time, you know, he was happy with it. He was content with it. And it definitely does put a different spin on it. And I'm not going to say like homelessness is a good thing, of course, but it's just a different side of like, these are people that just, they choose to live this way and they're happy living this way. And it made me more angry hearing about Amtrak and all that shit and, you know, coming in to clear them out.
When I heard about Amtrak, you were kind of talking about that, Eric, where they were trying to clean it up and they just couldn't keep up with it. Like every time they tried to clean it, they had to give up. I think it started in 2009 and I read that they would get rid of the graffiti, but nobody realized how long these tunnels really are too, like how far they go and stretch. And I remember it was like rooting for the rebels in Star Wars, you know, like I'm like, yeah, graffiti that shit up, you know, like I was so happy that they couldn't do it because I was pissed off at Amtrak too. They were like the Empire to me. But the one thing too, I think maybe Danny was bringing it up, but yeah, that's what I liked about your videos a lot too, was this human element, because you know, it made me dive a little deeper into, you know, how people become this way. Because most of the time we're told, you know, it's mental illness. It's people who, you know, smoke crack and made bad life choices. And, you know, they should have picked themselves up by their bootstraps. But like when you get into a lot of it, I mean, there's so many factors at play between domestic violence survivors who had to leave a bad situation. You mentioned health emergencies. I mean, in this country, you have to get rid of your kidney or something. You're bankrupt. You know, like you don't have a support system there. And, you know, one of the other interesting ones was like, you know, there's a lot of disintegration of family units and, you know, a bad family system. And then you end up on the streets as a kid. And I thought that was like, just the human element was really, really cool that you were able to show that. So,
oh, thanks.
You know, it's like, you know, we talked about in the last episode, the single residence occupancy, right? And the, you know, the decline of those in the city and the amount of people that just, and through gentrification as well, just people that had homes that are just, you know, they don't exist anymore. You know, I was going to bring it up before, you know, we talked about the geography, right, of the location. It was fortunate for Walter and for Carlos to live where they lived, right, because they had so many resources around them. You know, I mean, anything you need, you're in New York City, anything you need, you're going to get it. And especially if you know where to look and you know people, you're going to be just, you know, you're going to be fine. You'll get it. You got to work for it, but you'll get it. But, you know, I couldn't help but think that if you look, I don't know, you go to like Montana, or somewhere very mountainous and someone goes to live off the grid and they built themselves like a little shack and they live off the land, the perspective of them is like, that's a true American, right? That's a man's man.
Yeah.
Right. And then yet
that's Ted Kaczynski, by the way, but okay.
Yeah. It's also Ted Kaczynski, by the way. But you know, the point is like, that's your mountain man. That's your manifest destiny type of situation. And yet somebody geographically living in New York City, who does the exact same thing, who moves away from society, off the grid, and lives in cubby 20 feet up in the air, and again, lives off of the land and off of the resources, they're looked at as like a menace and a scary person and who should be avoided. And it's just, it's interesting how the juxtaposition between these two things, you know, specifically with locations and geography, can really change how people look and view individuals that just choose to live life on the fringes, and they don't necessarily need to get in the middle of society. So I didn't think about that until now, but it's interesting, right? You know, minus the Ted Kaczynski bomb making, but normal folks that just want to live on their own and do their own thing, they're applauded by society. They're applauded as, you're a man's man. That's a real American right there, you know? And yet somebody who's in New York City does it, and it's like, oh, we got to get rid of this person. You know, we don't want to see that person.
It's funny you mention that, because like a lot of on my YouTube videos of Carlos and Walter, as well as other folks, a lot of people write comments about, oh, why don't they go live in the woods or whatnot? And it's like, well, you know, for one thing, there aren't as many resources readily available. For another, there's no people. Like, what if people are social creatures? But mm-hmm. most importantly, they're still trespassing if they're in the woods.
True. You're right. Somebody owns that land.
Yep. Someone owns every piece of land on this planet.
Yeah.
So where are the people that don't want to be part of, you know, our normal, quote unquote, normal society? Where are they supposed to go? Because they're trespassing no matter where they go.
Yeah, no matter where they go, but it seems to be more acceptable, right, to sweep some people out rather than other people. Back to Walter real quick. So he was one of the last, right? He was one of the last remaining mole people from its peak from the 80s and the 90s. You know, did he have any stories that you weren't able to get on film that really kind of gave you a sense of what the community was like back then?
Not so much him, but I spoke with another gentleman on the phone who hopefully I can coordinate an interview. He works now, and he seems to work a lot. He works a union gig in the day and then works as a bartender at night. He's
nice.
Just really trying to rake in his money, you know. But he had told me some of the stories. He was actually in that movie Dark Days for a little bit. And okay. he had told me some stories. And what he had told me, unfortunately, was that the last he had heard, a lot of the folks that were in that documentary basically all fell off the wagon, and most of them OD'd and have passed away now. He made it sound like kind of like what Walter had implied, that it was kind of real mayhem, you know. It was, and a lot of the folks that were living, you know, down on the tracks in the shanty town it was kind of a very party environment and party atmosphere. And, you know, if there was a dispute, someone would just knock your house down or set it on fire, and, you know, could get kind of dangerous when you get that many people, sure. many of whom I guess did have substance abuse problems.
It's just a wild story, you know, and it's a wild existence, you know, especially, you know, just to think of that there's potentially, like Jay had mentioned before, it's potentially 2,000 to 5,000 people. I mean, I've read anywhere between 2 and upwards of 5 that, you know, are still potentially living in tunnels underneath New York City, you know, with the crazy. I mean, like, we, you know, I worked in Manhattan before. I mean, we've all spent time there, you know, and just to think there's never a time of day where there is not the hustle and bustle, you know, like.
Yeah. It's,
you know, when they say the city that never sleeps, it's legitimately, you know, like, you want Chinese food at 2 a.m, you find it. Like, you'll be good. You know, it's crazy to think that there's these two levels of existence happening that could not be, you know, any more different from each other. It's crazy.
I almost think of it as like three levels, though. You know what I mean? Like, so you have the one under, like, you have the surface level, which is probably me and you and people living in the city. Sure. Then there's like the penthouse crew.
Fair enough.
Up top, right in the air, which is the height of opulence. And then you have something totally different underneath your feet. So you're like right in between, you know, two very differing, you know, polar opposites.
Sure.
That's the way I thought of it. Like, and a lot of it, they were talking about, a lot of these places, they're under rich areas, like very, well, it's Manhattan, but, you know, more upscale Manhattan area. But yeah, that was wild to me, thinking that, like, wow, there's just like a whole life there. And some of me thinks, like, these people beat the system. You know what I mean? Like,
for sure.
They beat the hustle and bustle, right? Like, they knew where to get the food, where to get electricity, and just.
I think the electricity part is the most fascinating thing to me.
That blew my mind.
Every time I saw it. And I was like, well, of course, like, it makes so much sense.
Totally makes sense.
But I was just like, I never even thought of that. These guys have electricity. Yeah. They have refrigerators. They have computers. Like, crazy. They had phones.
It was funny because Walter was like, yeah, I don't know if he had said he got it straight from him, but he had mentioned, like, you know, hey, you go down to Trump's place. multiple times. And I was like, is Walter stealing from Trump? It's like, that's hilarious. Him, yeah. Where'd you go, Walt?
Yeah, that was funny.
But sure, yeah. I mean, it's just an interesting, you know, it's such an interesting juxtaposition, man. And again, you know, Eric, thank you for making those videos for real, you know, and it's interesting because Mike, who is not able to join us tonight, he was actually the guy that suggested this topic. Again, when he had said it, like I had mentioned earlier, I don't know if you were recording or not, but I was thinking like, you know, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, like mole people, like, what is this? Like a conspiracy theory, you know, like, you know, government engineered, you know, mutants. And then I look into it, I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then your videos were just such an important part of my research into this topic. And more so to give a human side and to look at the human story. And I think to me, that's just so much more valuable than any statistics and any, you know, quotes from anywhere else or any books that are written, but to literally just hear a human being tell about this particular topic from their experiences and to see, you know, the look in their eyes when they are saying what they're saying and telling their stories. You, like I said, by the end of that Walter video, when it mentioned that he had passed, like that legitimately like upset me. Like I was upset, and it wasn't a particularly long, you know, documentary that you made, but it was so it was so powerful that by the end, like I was invested emotionally in Walter. And then finding that he passed, I was like, I was really bummed, you know? And then, but watching the Carlos video, you caught back up with him and that he was genuinely doing all right. And he was happy. And it was like this emotional roller coaster. Everything about this particular topic brought me to such highs and lows. And I don't think I would have reached those emotional high peaks or and valleys without seeing your videos. Thank you. And I think it's just such an important.
Bravo.
Yeah, for real. Like, it's such an important thing to have out there.
I got one question. Yeah, Eric, I'm, you know, thank you for doing what you do, as we're all New Yorkers and it's our home too. Have you been to other cities, major cities, or have you thought about?
No question.
Oh, I'm sorry, dude. Because I know there were videos like about like Las Vegas and stuff. Have you been interested in doing something?
That's what
like
I
that?
Wanted to know. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't been there. I've interviewed homeless folks in, I guess they're technically not homeless, but a group of people living on boats in San Francisco Bay off of Sausalito. And I met a woman in somewhere in Georgia. I can't remember the name of the town right offhand, where she was busking. So she was playing violin for money and basically just living off grid out of her car and sleeping in a tent in a wildlife management area. So like, you know, I kind of try to keep an eye out, and I'm always on the lookout for other interesting stories. I have another one in that I'm hoping, I haven't secured permission yet. A gentleman here in the Northeast who in New England, who actually he has a homeless camp in his backyard, basically. He's just allowing folks to live there. So I'm hoping to be able to speak with them and see what that's all about. Like, I'm always on the lookout and just trying to see, like you guys said, trying to humanize. I'm like, a big part of these documentaries, what I try to do is my viewpoint is, you know, I try to fact check people when I can, but when someone's telling me their life history and it goes back decades, I have no way to verify that. So mostly sure. I'm documenting my interaction with another human being. That's what it is, you know? And sure. So I try to focus on that. And, you know, I think, you know, like what you were saying about kind of breaking stereotypes, it's like, it's funny, on the first Walter video, the shortened version, one of my favorite comments I got was someone wrote, imagine my surprise when I got to the end and the guy doing the interviewing looked homeless also, you know, so it's I got a big beard, you know, I'm scruffy looking. And it's like, I think that's a big help as to, you know, made me laugh. I definitely hit the thumbs up on that one. My wife still laughs about it. But it's like, you know, that's part of why I think able to, you know, have a normal conversation with these folks. You know, I'm not a news crew rolling up on somebody with a mic with my little logo on it and sticking it in their face, you know.
You're a real person, yeah.
Yeah.
You had said that, you know, that you kind of recorded the first time you were talking to Walter, but how long was it before you actually like stepped into his home? Was it like the same day? Did you have to meet him a few times? Like how long did it kind of get?
Oh, that was the very next week. We made a.
That's right. He gave you the directions. And you followed the directions. Okay.
So Yeah, I don't remember offhand. I mean, I could check the metadata on the video file, but it's like, I think I met him on one Saturday and then met him the next Saturday. Or met him in his home the next Saturday.
That's so cool. Like, that's really just, cool. You know, like, it really is.
It's unfortunate. So, like, Carlos, I met him, like I said, I'm pretty sure it might have been the first time I ever went to the tunnel, maybe the second. But then I ran into him several more times. Just, you know, we didn't plan anything out. It was just like, oh, I'm going to go there and maybe he'll be there. And then eventually life gets in the way. I have a job, I have to work, and I couldn't get down there as often. And then the next few times I went down, nobody was around anywhere. And then eventually I just kind of stopped going down there, you know? So it's kind of, you know, in a way I'm kind of, I don't want to say regretting it because, you know, whatever, life is what it is. But it would have been nice if I had persisted and not gotten sidetracked with other things and, you know, periodically checked in to see how they were doing and foster a friendship with them for longer, you know?
But I mean, you essentially did with Carlos, right? You met back up with Carlos. He wasn't sure if he remembered you or not. And then then everything clicked. And, you know, as you said, you still keep in touch with him. So, I mean, out of all of this, at the very least, right, we got to learn, public got to learn, got to see a beautiful story. And you got a friend prior maybe to your life as a documentarian. I don't think you probably would have imagined, you know, like you would have been friends with a, you know, quote unquote mole person. That's awesome, man. So my last question for you is completely has nothing to do with this. You shot a Bigfoot documentary.
I knew it. I knew that would come up.
Were you convinced? Are you a Bigfoot believer?
No, I'm not. Yeah. I don't want to say I'm not a believer. I believe that a lot of the people that I have interviewed and that I've spoken with, they saw something.
Okay.
You know,
fair enough.
I believe their stories.
Eat that,
and even
Joe.
a lot of them, what they'll say oftentimes is the only thing that makes sense or the only way I can explain it to someone else is to say it was Bigfoot. You know, like they don't claim that. They just say, I don't know what it was. This is the only thing that I could think of that would explain it to other people, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, at this point, I actually have two more kind of unfinished documentaries with interviewing folks who have either seen something or are looking for Bigfoot. And I would say it's at least 15, 16 people, maybe even more at this. And there's only about four of them that I don't really believe.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
See? Yo, you lose.
Well, I have a final question to have a tiebreaker here. Eric, you're a New Yorker as well, so settle the debate. Is it Mets or Yankees, please?
Oh, I'm not a baseball guy. I will say the Yankees logo is cooler, though.
Thank you. I got two. I'm stuck here with two Mets fans, so.
I don't know if we can publish this episode now. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's over.
It's one of those things where even Yankees fans can't stand Yankees fans.
That is true.
A fair point.
True.
Agreed.
That's a fair point. I was just on Twitter earlier before we came on. I'll end with this. There was a Yankee fan who, like, quote, tweeted the gestational period of a pregnant woman. And she's like, imagine going through all of this and then your kid grows up to be a Mets fan. And I was like, damn, like, you spend this much time thinking about Mets fans? I was like, that's just awful.
I always think you have to have some, like, being a Mets fan is like,
they have a steel soul.
You could take, you could take, it's such a miserable existence that, like, in order to get through it, you know, you have to have something inside of you that's just strong.
You guys can handle failure more than I can. I agree.
Absolutely, totally. And so my son will understand what failure and disappointment is like at a very young age.
That's what I always told him.
And he will grow faster than most other children because he will have these life lessons due to the New York Mets and their shitty baseball.
Well, look at it like this. So my brother-in-law is a Red Sox fan. He's from Massachusetts. And I mean, him and his buddies used to get season tickets every year. He might still get them, I don't know. But for so many years, obviously, they just kept coming so close.
Yeah, the curse.
And then when they finally won, I mean, that dude, he was like dancing on the clouds, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, fair enough.
There's always that, you know?
It's coming. It's coming, man.
I'm Mets, Jets, and Knicks. So it's like, I'm just, I'm I don't know what my problem is with myself, but I got to work on myself, I guess.
Number one, you live in Jersey. That's the first problem, but yeah.
I was born in Brooklyn. Told you.
Fair enough. Love it. Oh, man. All right. On that
Thanks
note,
so much, Eric.
Eric, thank you so, so much for taking your time to speak with us on just such an amazing topic. And again, you know, I said it a bunch of times already. Thank you for doing what you did. And making what you made, because it was just, I mean, again, if you're listening and you haven't checked out Eric's YouTube channel, please do. You have to watch the video specifically about Walter and Carlos. They're just amazing. Like, you want to just get the feels and you want to feel like a human being for a little bit. You got to watch these videos. They're phenomenal. Documentaries. I apologize. You got to watch these documentaries. You know, they're done incredibly well. Eric, your voice, your narration voice is just phenomenal. Like, you just have a great narration voice.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. All right, guys. I think we hit this one pretty hard. Until next time, stay you, stay weird, stay out there. Remember, there's more to history than what's in the books. Adios, friends.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Story Of. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @PodcastStoryOf. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is a production of Unfiltered Studios. If you would like to know more about joining Unfiltered Studios, please visit our website at unfpod.com for more information.